I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, we're going to talk one-on-one with best-selling author and Indiana resident John Green. Green is the author of The Fault in Our Stars, soon to be a movie, and other books. He has a reader base and fan following that stretches around the globe, as we learned a little more than a year ago when he appeared on this show, and we got calls from Europe and the Middle East. To join the conversation with John Green this time, please call 1-866-476-3881. Email us at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or locate us on Twitter at WFYI. Now, this news.
Support is provided by WGU Indiana, Indiana's 8th state university. Information about earning a degree from WGU, an accredited online nonprofit university, is available at indiana.wgu.edu. And by Apparatus, supporting Big Brothers Big Sisters of Central Indiana during National Mentoring Month in January. More on how to become a Big Brother Big Sister or be a part of a big couple at bebigforkids.org.
Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We're talking with author John Green today. He's an Indianapolis resident and best-selling author, the author of The Fault in Our Stars, which is soon to be a major motion picture. If you would like to join the conversation, you can do so by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or you can locate us on Twitter at WFYI. John, welcome back to the program. It's good to have you back here in the studio.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Last time we were here, you just won the Indiana Authors Award, and a lot of things. You've been through a couple of changes. It's been a little more than a year since then. Probably the biggest one. You've had another child, right?
Yeah, that is definitely the biggest change.
And then obviously the movie is the other big thing. Why don't we talk about the personal stuff? Tell us a little bit about your child.
My daughter Alice was born in June, and so now we have two children at home, which is a big adjustment, but it's a lot of fun. It's really it's been a pleasure to be around her, and even though this has been a crazy year and lots of wonderful things have been happening professionally, the personal stuff is really where you find the most fulfillment in life, so it's been great.
Your children's names are Henry and June?
Henry and Alice,
I'm sorry. June was the month. Yes. Well, and then the other big one, and we've already got questions coming in on this, is that your most recent book, The Fault in Our Stars, is being made into a movie. Could you tell us a little bit about what that experience has been like?
Yeah, I mean, it's completely surreal. I was there. I was really lucky that I was able to be there for almost the entire filming of the movie. That's very rare for authors to be able to be on the set that often. Usually the author of a book comes for a couple days. But I was really welcomed there by the director, Josh Boone, and by the producers. And I became really good friends with the actors. And that was a really special experience for me, because those people are going to be Hazel and Gus, the main characters in the novel, and Isaac and Hazel's parents. Those are going to be those people, those characters, for a lot of people who encounter the story. So it was really special for me to get to know them so well. And I just feel really lucky that they took it so seriously. A lot of them are quite young, but they were so deeply committed to it. And yeah, I think that shows.
Did you have any trepidation about it being made into a movie?
Oh yeah, of course. I mean, it's difficult because that's when your control ends. The only decision that you can make is whether to sell the rights. And if you do, then you don't have any more decisions. You don't have any more control. I was really lucky that the people who were involved in the movie cared about what I thought. And so from the beginning, I've been able to be involved in any way that I wanted to be, and they've always listened to me very carefully. And, it's been a really wonderful experience, but I also know that that's quite rare. You know, I've also had terrible experiences in Hollywood. So this has been a very blessed.
What have been some of the terrible ones?
Well, I mean, all of my other
books. You
can
books protect
were,
the name, yeah. names of the guilty.
Yeah, I'm going to try not to. I'm not going to okay. name anybody. But all of my previous books were optioned and you know, developed to one extent or another. And I tried to adapt one of my own books, Paper Towns, a few years ago. And that was a disaster on many levels, starting with me being a terrible screenwriter. But it was all of those experiences really went into this one and allowed me to maybe have a little more perspective than I have in the past.
We've gotten a question from a listener who didn't want to go on the air named Jennifer, who says, your novel, The Fault in Our Stars, is becoming an on-screen film. Will it be the same as the novel, or will the viewers see some differences?
Well, it won't be the same. Because books are made of text. Like, the magic of reading to me is that you have to be an active participant in the creation of the narrative, because those words are just meaningless scratches on a page until you bring your intellect to them and translate them into ideas that live in your head.
And the action has
exactly. It takes place inside your mind. And mm-hmm. and that's just a very different experience than an image-driven narrative or a sound-driven narrative, and I think movies are both. So it's always going to be different. And of course, if you're condensing a 350-page novel into 2 hours, there's some stuff that's going to be lost. But all of that noted, I think it's an extraordinarily faithful adaptation, one of the most faithful adaptations I've seen.
Was that important to you that they adhere to what you'd done?
I told them over and over again, I don't care if it's faithful, I care if it's good.
Okay.
But they managed to do both.
We are talking with author John Green here on No Limits. If you would like to join the conversation, please call us at 1-866-476-3881. Thomas, welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi. What's on your mind?
I'm wondering, why was the movie filmed in Pittsburgh and not Indiana? I'm wondering, how are they going to recreate like Holiday World, since it is Holiday Park, since it is in the story some?
That's a great
Thanks
question.
Thanks very much for the call and question, Thomas.
They did not film the movie in Indiana because it would have cost a lot more money to do so, because Indiana doesn't have tax breaks, and also because the states that do have tax breaks, like Pennsylvania, have a lot more They have really experienced crews who have been making movies full time for 20 years. So they filmed it in Pittsburgh. The answer to your question is that the parks are recreated. Like, there's a really important scene in the novel that takes place at Funky Bones, a couple scenes actually. And both of those are in the movie. Funky Bones is a sculpture at the IMA's Art and Nature Park.
Mm-hmm.
And they just recreated Funky Bones. It was the most extraordinary thing I've ever seen. I brought my wife, who curated the project, to Pittsburgh that day, and she couldn't tell the difference. So they worked really, really hard to make it look and feel like Indianapolis. So we just had to find some flat streets in Pittsburgh.
Yeah, I was going to say that Pittsburgh is not the first city I would think of as a stand-in for.
No.
Omaha, maybe. But,
yeah, well, the nice thing about Pittsburgh is that it does have the kinds of neighborhoods that I was writing about. But, you know, North Central High School was really great about providing lots of stuff, so that which is where Gus goes to high school. They were awesome. So I really think it's going to look and feel like Indianapolis. But I was a little bummed out that they couldn't make the movie here, but it would have been prohibitively expensive.
We've also gotten an email or a question from a listener who did not want to go on the air, named Lee, who says, how does it make you feel to know that The Fault in Our Stars and your other novels have influenced teenagers everywhere? Did you ever expect it to become as big as it did?
No, I mean, no. I couldn't have even imagined what that would be like to imagine, if that makes any sense. As for the thought that my work influences people's lives, I'm very grateful for that. But I also am aware that it's kind of a mutual generosity. They have to be really generous readers in order to draw something meaningful and important to them from the novel, just as I have to try my best to be a generous writer. So that gratitude goes both ways, and I try my best to internalize that it's not primarily my work, it's primarily people's response to it.
What sort of responsibility do you feel to your audience? And that we were talking before we went on the air about sort of the you started out as a writer, and then at some point you also become a celebrity when you hit a level of success, which means then that there are expectations, not just from your writing, but from how you conduct yourself and all of that.
Yeah, I mean, I try not to, like, drag race and get a DUI in Miami. I do feel a responsibility to my audience to try to be to try to be a reasonably good individual, but I also feel that responsibility to my family and to my friends and to myself.
Yeah.
So that, I think most of that predates any of the celebrity stuff, but it certainly is. Yeah, it's not something that I ever expected to have in my life.
Was it weird making the adjustment to that, to realizing, oh, you know, maybe I just can't walk out without combing my hair and, you know, wearing my sweats or whatever?
I just don't mind if people see me in my sweats, and I've never combed my hair. But it is weird, and I think I'm still making that transition. So I think sometimes I do struggle with it, but it is a as difficulties go, it's a pretty good one to have.
Well, I've got an acquaintance who's sort of connected to the whole Star Wars phenomenon, and not a major player, but some of the stories he shares of people who are really obsessive about that come across as a little bit, you know, at least they provoke anxiety, if not fear.
Right.
Are there parts of it that make you a little nervous or make you uncomfortable?
Well, I mean, the first thing that I would say in response to that is that I'm a very anxious person, so I can't speak for rational responses. I can only speak for anxious person responses. But, you know, there are parts that can make me uncomfortable sometimes. But I grew up as a huge nerd, and I'm still a big nerd, and I'm a great advocate for unironic enthusiasm and unashamed, unabashed enthusiasm, and I love that, and it's something that I really value. And if people feel that way about the stuff that I make, then I'm just so grateful, because I've been a fanboy my whole life.
We are talking with the author John Green here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. Emily, welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hello. What's on your mind?
Holy cow, I didn't think I'd actually get on air. So, hi, I was just going to ask, I was wondering, John, how's the Wimbly-Womblies doing this year?
Okay, John, you probably should provide some context there.
Sure.
Thank you very much for the call, Emily.
Thanks, Emily. The AFC Wimbledon Wimbly-Womblies are a fictional soccer team that I have created based on an actual soccer team, AFC Wimbledon, that plays in the fourth tier of English soccer. Very briefly, this is an important and special team because their team was stolen away from them. There is no equivalent to the franchise system where you can just move the Colts from Baltimore to Indianapolis because teams are seen as being owned by their supporters, but they aren't actually owned by their supporters. So this team, AFC Wimbledon, started about 11 years ago, and they worked their way up from the ninth tier in English football all the way back to being a real professional team again. And our community has decided to use the proceeds from the videos that I make playing this soccer game as to support the actual AFC Wimbledon. So we've become like one of their larger sponsors.
We've gotten a question from a listener named Zoe. And I should say, we've got a lot of calls and we're getting a lot of questions. So I'm going to ask the people who call in, please be ready to ask the question so we can get as many people as possible in here. Have you ever thought about writing a sequel to one of your books? And could you tell us about any of your upcoming books?
I've never thought about writing a sequel. It seems really hard. I have a lot of friends who write series, and it seems like a terrible, terrible burden, particularly when you get to that last book in the series and you realize that you have to make everything, you have to tie everything up, and there are all these problems that you created that you didn't actually think of solutions for. So life is long, and hopefully, and I don't know if I'll ever write a sequel, but I don't particularly feel the need to. I like to leave the characters in my novels in a place where I'm comfortable leaving them, and that often means a measure of ambiguity, but hopefully not so much that that you feel that the story is totally unresolved.
Are there any of the characters that you miss that you'd like to revisit?
I do miss the characters, but I also don't want to revisit them. You know, I do think about the pleasures of writing them or the intensity of writing certain characters at times in my life. But I don't miss them exactly. I'm kind of glad that it's no longer my problem. You know, like, writing a novel is fun, and but it's also quite isolating and challenging at times. And I'm always relieved when it becomes the reader's problem, and not mine.
We are talking with author John Green here on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, please call 1-866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimitswfyi.org. Find us on Twitter or on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We're talking with Indianapolis resident and best-selling author John Green today. If you would like to join the conversation, you can do so by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. Chris, welcome to the program.
Hey, guys. First time, long time.
It's my best friend, Chris.
Oh, this is, oh, okay.
No.
You recognize the voice.
Chris, I recognize your voice immediately.
Okay.
No, this is.
All right, well, we're not going to drop the call then. Get your question in.
Hey, John, since you lived in Indianapolis, you've seen a huge upshot in your fame and notoriety. How do you think that's going to affect your future novels?
It's a great question, Chris. That really is. That's my best friend. Big part of the reason that we still live in Indianapolis. At Watigi on Twitter. Indianapolis has been extraordinarily good to me. People always talk about, it's interesting, Chris, because people always talk about the fact that, like, you got to live in New York or LA to write for a living. And I do think it was helpful to me to live in New York for a couple of years before we moved here, and got to know my publisher better. But in the end, living in a city like Indianapolis is much more helpful to me as a writer, because I'm reminded that, like, my little pond is not the only pond in the world, that the pond of writing novels is not the only thing that people do for a living. And that's been very important to me. But also just, you know, the friendships that we've made here and the relationships. And it's just a great place to raise our kids. So I feel very lucky to live here.
Thanks very much for the call, Chris.
Yeah, no problem. Love the show. Maybe you could get a better guest and not settle.
All right. Thanks
guys.
Much. That is spoken like a true best friend there. A little bit of... We've gotten a couple of questions, tweets dealing with the same thing. People wanting to know your feelings on House Joint Resolution 3. I know you took to social media on that.
Yeah.
Could you talk a little bit about that and maybe bring people up to date on what happened yesterday as well?
Yes, they removed the vital second sentence from, that's right, and yesterday,
yeah.
I'm a proponent of marriage equality and an opponent of discrimination, so it's pretty simple to me.
Okay. We've gotten a tweet also from a listener who's identifies himself or herself as Gux Waters. Says, why don't you reply to snail mail?
That's a good question. Mostly because of volume. It's just really kind of not possible right now. Maybe if I had like a large crew of people or something to help me with that, but I don't. I don't have like a full-time assistant or anything. It's just me. So it's just not possible at the moment. Hopefully it will be at some point.
And is that something that you look forward to? I mean, I don't get the sense from talking to you that you want to become the next James Patterson, you know, and be a kind of a fiction factory and an industry. Really.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I'm it takes me
not
like
to disparage the people who read James Patterson.
No, I'm among those people, but, yeah. It takes me 3 years to write a novel if I'm lucky. So, I'll never be an effective fiction factory.
We are talking with the author John Green here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. Carlos, welcome to the program.
Hi, good to have you. I learned your... I'll make it quick like you asked me to.
Thank you.
John, I was curious. John, I was wondering if all your success that you found in writing The Fault in Our Stars, I was wondering how that affected the Vlogbrothers and, like, making the YouTube videos with Hank. I know that you guys have a great relationship and all that, and I was curious if, like, rocketing up to the top of the bestseller list and, you know, getting so much notoriety for this affected, you know, the way you make videos and stuff like that.
That's a good question. Thanks.
Thanks very much for the call, Carlos.
Yeah, so my brother and I have had this online video project for more than 7 years now where we make videos back and forth to each other. And in a sense, that the online video work that I do is my day job and has always been my day job since I moved to Indianapolis. And it still is. I still go to the office every day, and we make educational video, a series called Crash Course, where I teach history, and we make video for Mental Floss magazine, and then we also have this channel, Vlogbrothers, that I just shoot in my basement. In fact, I was editing a video, my video for today, right before I came on the show today. It hasn't changed it much. My brother and I's relationship is really very, very close and personal, and we have absolutely no professional jealousy. Hank is extraordinarily successful in what he does. And
what does he do?
He runs the biggest online video conference, VidCon, and he also owns this gigantic company called DFTBA Records that basically produces and distributes merchandise and music for artists who have built a following on the internet. And, you know, and we also make Vlogbrothers videos, and he works on Crash Course, and he has other channels as well. So, I mean, he just won an Emmy. Mm-hmm. So if anybody's jealous of anyone, it's me of him.
He's doing okay.
Yeah, he's doing fine. Okay.
We've gotten an email question from a listener named Kara. If you would like to send us an email question, you can do so by sending it to nolimits@wfyi.org. Says, I am a former middle school teacher and parent. One of the things that I like about reading adolescent lit is that it opens up opportunities to have conversations about things like sexuality and drugs in ways that are less awkward and a little more organic. When you write, do you ever consider the conversations that teachers and parents might have with their teenagers? Do you try to plant material, like in Looking for Alaska? And then she closes by saying, P.S. I have kids roughly the same age as yours, 3 years and 4 months. If you and the family would ever like to come over for a kid's play date, pizza, and Cards Against Humanity, let us know. All right, we'll deal with Kara's question first, and the social stuff you guys can work out on your own afterwards.
I love that game, Cards Against Humanity. I don't plant anything. You know, when I'm writing a book, I try really hard just to write the best story that I can write, the most honest story that I can write, not worry too much about the overt, like, social consequences of that. I mean, I try to be a responsible writer, but I try not to focus too much on that. But if you're doing your job, it arises organically because, you know, all that stuff is part of teenagers' lives. And so when I try to, you know, if I write about sex, it's because I think that it would be part of the character's experience.
We are talking with author John Green. Danielle, welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi. What's on your mind?
I have a question. My question is, out of all the books that you've written, which one is your favorite?
Yeah.
Sort of like asking you to name your favorite child, right? But
right.
Thanks
but everyone
very much for the call.
But everyone has a secret favorite child. For my parents, it's me. It's clearly my brother, actually.
No, yeah. I thought you said there were no sibling rivalries.
Clearly there is.
Yeah.
You know, I guess my favorite of my books is probably The Fault in Our Stars. But I also have a very soft spot for Looking for Alaska. My first novel was very personal, semi-autobiographical boarding school book. So one of those two. But that said, I also look back upon all of them with a measure of, oh my God, I can't believe I wrote that. It's so horrible, which I think is probably universal among writers. But yeah, I definitely like don't reread my work or anything because I find it pretty similar to torture.
How does the process start for you for a book? I mean, does it start with a character? Does it start with a theme you want to explore? Does it start, you know, with a setting?
It starts with characters for me, but the characters are in a situation, you know, so. Everything flows from that character in that moment, that initial moment is that leads to the sort of spiraling out of the novel. I think that novels are very geometric at their core, and they always begin with a point, and then from that point emerges lines or shapes.
We've gotten an email question from a listener named Hope, who says, what you have written flies in the face of a lot of stereotypes. How do you deal with the controversy when people say The Fault in Our Stars is exploitive of cancer patients, or just hoorah?
Well, I mean, my response to people feeling it's too raw is that, I tried to write as honest a story as I could. I am very sensitive to the criticism that it might be exploitative of young people living with cancer, or that it might be exploitative of the disease itself. I tried really hard not to do that in the process. I mean, the book was largely inspired by my own time as a hospital chaplain, and then by having a good friend who died of cancer when she was 16, whose book, The Star Won't Go Out, her memoir just came out today. And I'm thrilled about that. I had a lot of young people with cancer read the book. I had a lot of, before it came out, I had a lot of parents of kids who'd lost kids to cancer read the book as well, and oncologists and other people, because I really didn't want to write an exploitative book. I didn't want to write sort of the typical romanticized, sentimentalized cancer novel. I really wanted to try hard to through some of that stuff.
Not have it be Ally McGraw at the end of Love Story, basically.
Yeah, I didn't want to write Love
Story.
Looking
like a model.
yeah. I mean, I wanted to I wanted to argue that short lives can also be good lives, and that short lives can also be rich and full and complex lives. And I think too often the narrative around serious illness in young people sentimentalizes their life in a way that kind of dehumanizes them or essentializes them. And I wanted to try to write a more complex story than that. But whether I succeeded is for the reader to decide.
Got a question from a listener named Ashley, Ben Davis High School student, says, how is the art assignment going, and what kind of feedback are you getting? And also wants to know how Henry, your son.
Henry's doing great.
The
art assignment is, my wife, Sarah, was a curator of contemporary art at the IMA for many years, and recently left to start a show with PBS Digital called The Art Assignment, where she goes around the country and meets with artists in their working spaces and gets art assignments from them that then we can all do. It's going great, but I'm not really doing much on it. It's Sarah's job, not mine. It's going really well. The first one premieres in late February, and I saw an early cut of it. I think it's really wonderful. It's one of the most interesting online video projects I've seen.
There's a level of knowledge about your life, not just your work.
I know.
But your life, do you find that, exhilarating or disturbing or both?
Oh, it doesn't bother me. I mean, I think it almost always comes from a place of, genuine, what's the word for genuineness? I'm a novelist. Whatever that word is. Authenticity. Yeah, I think it comes from a place of, that there is an authentic relationship that I have with my audience and that I'm really lucky to have, and I wouldn't give up for anything. That said, there have to be boundaries. It's not cool. It's not cool when people come to my house. It's not cool when people drop stuff off in my mailbox. There are boundaries, and those are important to acknowledge and to respect. But I feel really lucky that I get to have a relationship with my readers that is so much richer than the relationship that I had with, the writers I liked when I was growing up.
Estridge, welcome to the program.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
Okay, I'm coming for friends. I didn't expect
yes.
to hear you. Hi. John, if you could meet an author that inspires you to learn about writing, I'd like to meet you, but I would want to know who you would like to meet. And I'm having a book club with a friend, and our theme is queer. Which book would you advise us to read this month?
Those are
good questions. Thank you very much for the call, Estridge, and thank you for listening all the way from across the pond.
Yeah, I'm very excited.
Thanks.
So I've immediately forgotten the first question.
First question is, what author would you like to meet? And presumably, we could start. Who was the author that you most admired?
You know, when I was growing...
Because we've gotten several questions
like
that.
Yeah, when I was growing up, the author I most admired was J.D. Salinger. But also, by the time I was in high school, I became a huge fan of Toni Morrison, whose work was taught in the English class that I had in high school. We read The Bluest Eye and then Beloved and then Song of Solomon. So I was a huge fan of Toni Morrison, Michael Chabon. And then when I was a freshman in college or a senior in high school, I can't remember, I read Infinite Jest by David Foster Wallace. That was the first really exhilarating experience I had with a contemporary novel. So if I could, you know... Yeah, if I could meet with someone who'd influenced my writing the most, it would probably be David Foster Wallace. That said, I mean, he has since died, so that's mm-hmm. not possible. But I also don't know that I would necessarily actually want that, because I think sometimes, you know, people in real life can be disappointing. So, yeah, I don't know. I worry that I don't live up to people's expectations, and I would hate for David Foster Wallace to disappoint me. As for a suggestion for your book club... That's such an interesting question. There's this book by T. Cooper called, I think it's called Lipschitz Six or Two Angry Blondes. That's a weird transgender, multi-generational novel that's really beautiful and interesting. And if that's published in France, I would go with that one.
And that's the other part of this is, in addition to writing your own books, you regularly make recommendations of other books.
I do. Yeah, I love to.
How many books do you read in the course of a year?
Geez, not as many as I did before I had my second child.
Well, yeah, that life does change.
But I try to read a book every week or two. I try to read pretty broadly. I mean, the main thing for me is to keep reading and to read very different kinds of books. Not always the stuff that I want to write, or not always the stuff even that I necessarily think I'll like. But to understand sort of what reading looks like in the United States.
We've gotten a question from a listener named Carly who says, what is your most embarrassing childhood story?
Oh, man, there were a lot of them, and most of them aren't funny. They're just, like, incredibly sad stories of being bullied and stuff. But I did have I had one of those prototypical childhood terrors where someone removed my swimsuit in a public pool and then took it far, far away, and there was no ability to get it back. And that was I was probably like 10, and that was pure terror. Yeah, that was probably my most embarrassing moment. Again, that's not that funny though. I should come up with a funny story.
Well,
for that.
Are you? It is interesting though. I mean, just in watching you, I get a little bit of a sense that creative Are you still able to access all of that stuff and draw upon those feelings? Because you do write, you know, you're beyond being an adolescent now by some distance, but you can recapture that experience very well in your writing.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I do. I think most people can probably remember their... I don't always remember the things that happened in high school, but I remember the feelings pretty well. You know, it's a very strange time of life to be kind of between innocence and experience, where you're asked to do a lot of adult things, but at the same time, the adult things that are happening to you are happening to you for the first time, and so they have an intensity about them that is totally unprecedented and really will never be repeated for the rest of your life. So it's a really interesting time to write about. I do remember the feelings a lot, especially the feelings of, you know, being afraid or being bullied, but then also the feelings of, you know, wanting to make sure that my place in the social order was secure.
We've also gotten a tweet. The question is, if you weren't a writer, what would you be?
I'd probably just be a full-time YouTuber. That's a pretty good job, I'm fortunate to have it. But that speaks to how much, like, the world economy or the American economy is constantly changing, that, like, the job that I would probably have is a job that didn't exist 10 years ago.
We are talking with the author, John Green, here on No Limits. If you would like to join the conversation, please call us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send us an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We're talking with noted author John Green on No Limits. If you would like to join the conversation, you can do so by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. Hot, welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hello. What's on your mind?
Hi. My question actually was already answered, but I just wanted to thank John Green for everything that he's written and everything that he's done. It's just he has really made an influence on my life, and I just wanted to say thank you.
Thank you. That means a lot to me. It's a weird, yeah, this is a weird way to try to have that conversation across, judging from your accent, at least a few hundred miles. I'm from Alabama, so
yeah, maybe you're from North Carolina.
Okay, well, my parents live in Western North Carolina now, so. But yeah, that means a lot to me, and I feel, like I said earlier, I do feel genuinely lucky that that you've like chosen to invest in my work. Thanks.
Thank you very much for the call. Gotten an email question from a listener named McKenzie. It says, "My name is McKenzie. I was unable to reach you by phone. I'm a teenager with multiple medical disorders. I think you are an amazing writer. I hold your books very close to my heart. My question is, how did you feel while writing your books? For example, did you feel happy, sad, excited, or sort of free when you were writing?"
Oh, that's really beautiful, McKenzie, that last phrase, sort of free. I think more than anything, that's how I feel. Like I laugh at my own jokes when I write, and I cried a lot while I was writing The Fault in Our Stars. I mean, a lot of The Fault in Our Stars was written in a period of kind of an intense grief and anger in the wake of my friend's death. But mostly I feel kind of free, at least when it's going well. I feel like I don't have to be myself for a while. There's something about being able to escape the kind of prison of one's own consciousness that really does feel kind of literally magical. When writing is going well for me, that's how I feel, and I'm always chasing that feeling.
When do you know that it's going well for you? What are the things that tell you?
Well, I wish I knew better, because then I would have written more books instead of half writing, you know, a dozen books and only being able to finish a few. But I know when I'm enjoying the experience, but writers are notoriously unreliable about their own work. I mean, Mark Twain thought his best book was Joan of Arc,
and William Faulkner thought A Fable.
Right,
was
exactly.
His best work.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you can't trust writers when they're analyzing their own stuff. But I love the feeling when I'm walking out of the coffee shop or out of the office or wherever I've been writing for the last few hours, and I just feel kind of drained and exhilarated and different. That's what I'm chasing, and you know, there's the pleasure of the click. I've heard a lot of writers refer to it as the click, when things start to click into place and you start to see how it's going to work. That's a really intense feeling when you're sort of solving the puzzles.
Gotten a question from a listener named Christina, which is a bit basic. What would you tell up-and-coming authors who want to be successful?
The first thing is to read broadly. Read romance novels and read thrillers and read literary fiction and read stuff written in the 16th century and read, you know, nonfiction about toads. I don't know. Read whatever you can to understand the world. And then also think about where you want your book to be, what kind of readers you want to have, and try to make stuff for them. I think writing works best when it's truly a gift, when it's something that you're making for people, not in hopes of fame or wealth or prizes or whatever it is that you think will validate your work, because nothing is ever really going to validate it. Ultimately, you have to make it as a gift. And so I find that when I'm focused on my readers, when I'm able to turn outward, I write a lot better and I end up getting closer to what I want.
Jeff, welcome to the program.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
John, I wanted to ask John what his favorite Mountain Goats album is.
I'm a big fan of this band, the Mountain Goats.
Thanks very much for the call.
Thank you. If you don't know them, you should.
Thank you.
They're a great, they're the best band in the history of the world. My favorite Mountain Goats album is called The Sunset Tree, but there are no bad ones.
There are no bad ones?
No, truly.
Okay, what genre?
The genre of excellence.
That is a fan.
Folk rock. I have a t-shirt that says I only listen to the Mountain Goats, and it's not far off. But yeah, they make all the kinds of music so that you never have to listen to anything else.
We've gotten one that makes reference to your wife. Said Sarah Green said in a Tumblr post, "I have learned John's creative process is fueled by doubt and anxiety. How do you deal with that and use it to benefit yourself?" That's from a listener named Abby.
Well, so the benefit of the core process for people who have anxiety disorders, like the core engagement, is this obsessive thinking pattern that it literally becomes impossible not to think about whatever the object of your focus is, whatever the object of your anxiety is, that you can't think about anything else even for a nanosecond. That's infuriating, and it makes you feel crazy, and it can be very harmful to your life. But it's also a lot of what you do as a fiction writer. I don't want to in any way conflate mental illness and creativity. I think that's a very dangerous thing, and I don't believe in that artists need to be damaged or anything like that. But that ability to cycle really, really fast through things that could happen, through all the great and or terrible things that can result from a decision or whatever, that's really key to writing fiction, because you need to be able to think about all the things, you know, all the options, and then choose among them, choose the best word, the best sentence, the best plot device, whatever it is. And so I do think that it's helpful to me, but I could also write without it, and I'd probably be better off.
Has it gotten less so or more so as you've worked through it?
I mean, the self-doubt doesn't improve with time, because you finish a book and then it comes out and people say nice things about it or negative things about it or whatever they say, and all you can do is kind of look at that book and think, like, how did I write that? Whether you're proud of it or not, you're just sort of baffled by the fact that you did that. And then you try to start anew, and you realize that you have no idea how to write a novel. At least that's been my experience so far. I mean, hopefully at some point I'll figure it out.
I've got an email question from a listener named Lisa, who says, "I know John's books are described as books for young adults, but I, 50-something, recently read The Fault in Our Stars and felt it was just as much a book for adults. I would love to hear John's thoughts about that, as well as how he manages to channel the teenage experience so well as an adult." We sort of dealt with channeling the teenage experience, but, you know, and I would agree with her, having read your work, that you capture the adult experience very well in there, too, and that at least the relationships often between parents and children are far more realistically depicted than in most other books.
Well, I mean, first off, thank you, Lisa. I feel really grateful to have adult readers, partly because they buy books in hardcover, which is nice, but also, you know, because it's just wonderful to have my stories reaching such a broad audience. It's something that I never imagined. I never really imagined having readers other than teenagers. I like writing about adolescence. I like it because it's such an intense period of human life, but also because it's reflective of a lot of the things that I find interesting about America. I think America is an adolescent nation in many ways, a nation coming of age, a nation trying to figure out sort of what it wants to be. But I also love the intensity of experience and the fact that teenagers are asking big, interesting questions about what it means to be a human, about suffering and joy and grief. And they're asking those questions in totally unironic ways, because they don't have to be distracted by mortgages. You know, they don't have to be distracted by worrying about whether their kids are, you know, sick and they're going to have to miss a day of work. And so there's something really joyful about being able to write that way, because I can't live that way anymore.
Maggie, welcome to the program.
Hi, I was wondering on John's opinions on Esther Earle's new book coming out today.
We made reference to that.
Yeah, so my friend Esther, thanks Maggie, my friend Esther, who died in 2010 when she was 16 of thyroid cancer, she was a huge inspiration to me in writing The Fault in Our Stars, but she was also just a really wonderful friend to me, and her journals and other writings have been collected into this really extraordinary book called This Star Won't Go Out that was just published today. And it's such a wonderful book. Like, I was blown away by it.
How did you get to know her?
I met her at a Harry Potter convention because I am a huge nerd, and Esther was a huge nerd. So my brother sings songs about Harry Potter, and he's part of a Wizard Rock band. And we were both at this Wizard Rock concert, and I can't dance, and she couldn't dance because she was on oxygen. So we've just kind of became friends, and we stayed friends ever forever after that.
We've gotten an email question from a listener who says her name's Martha, and she says she's 60 and above. I was in the audience at your presentation at the JCC. I was thrilled to see an audience of both youth and adults. What do you attribute your ability to strike a chord with such a range of ages?
I don't know. I mean, I never thought that I would be read by adults, or that adults would take my work particularly seriously. One of the pleasures of writing for teenagers actually is that you don't have to be caught up in that whole adult fiction literary world that's full of
Do you feel that's kind of a straitjacket to be called a young adult author?
It doesn't bother me. I mean, I know it bothers a lot of young adult authors, but it doesn't bother me precisely because I can do the work that I want to do without having to worry about being taken seriously and whether I'm going to win Pulitzer Prizes and stuff, you know? It allows me to be like a kind of popular fiction writer while also writing about the literary themes that interest me, and using the using the structures of literature in ways that interest me. So it's been really freeing for me, actually. And I'm not one of those young adult writers who has any kind of desire to be anything else. That said, part of that might be because I've been so fortunate in that particularly The Fault in Our Stars is now read primarily by grown-ups. So
do you worry about age? I mean, for some reason, the famous quote from Mick Jagger saying that he hoped he wasn't singing Satisfaction.
Yeah,
when he's 60, comes to mind here. And of course, he ended up doing just exactly that.
Yeah.
But do you worry about,
aging out?
Yeah, as it were.
I don't. I mean, I probably will age out. I mean, I probably will become irrelevant. But that's okay. Like, That's not so bad, really. I mean, as long as I can still do the work that interests me, it's okay. I want there to be, I'm excited about the prospect of new writers coming into the world of YA fiction and making writers like me irrelevant. Mm-hmm. But then, the great thing about writing for teenagers is that usually you get this great, or sometimes at least, you get this amazing third act. Writers like Judy Blume and Walter Dean Myers have written some of their best work in the last 10 years.
We have gotten a tweet from a listener named Megan who says, who was the hardest character to write about and watch in the movie? And why? She says, thanks for writing.
So the novel centers on these two young people, Hazel and Gus. It's narrated by this girl, Hazel, and she meets this boy, Gus, at a support group for teenage cancer survivors. They're both he's in remission. She's living with stage 4 cancer. And, writing about Gus was easy, but watching Ansel become Gus, I realized what an insane challenge I had created for him. And so it was really, that was really interesting because, Augustus Waters is a really complicated kid, and he has to be a lot of things at the same time. He has to be both very strong at times and extremely vulnerable at others. And Ansel just pulled it off brilliantly. I just saw the movie, so I'm still sort of awash in having seen it, but his performance in it is just spectacular.
We've gotten a question from a listener named Margaret. A tweet says, will you do any kind of nerd fighter tour for the movie premiere? And we probably explain, since we haven't done it so far, what nerd fighters are.
Yeah, the nerd fighter community is the community that came out of the videos that I made I've been making with my brother since 2007. We fight for nerds. Obviously, we are nerds. So we fight to defend intellectualism and to be excited and enthusiastic about the world around us. I don't know if there's going to be a Nerdfighter tour associated with the movie. That isn't totally my decision. It is largely the decision of people at the movie studio. So we'll find out in the next couple months.
Do you have any promotional obligations in regard to the movie, or is it?
Yes.
Yes, you do. Okay.
I do.
All right. Merity, welcome to the program. Merity? Well, when is the movie coming out?
June 6th.
June 6th. So yeah. We're just, less than 6 months away from it.
Yeah.
Are you nervous about the public attention it's going to focus on? I mean, you've already have a considerable degree of celebrity here. I would imagine this is going to ratchet it up even more.
Yeah, I'm a little nervous about it, but I'm really excited for the story to get to more people. I mean, it's a completely different thing. Movie budgets and movie promotions are just on a whole different scale than book publishing. So I'm really excited about it. There's part of me that's a little bit terrified about whatever brief crush will happen just before and after the movie, but it should be fun.
Kelsey, we've got about 10 seconds to get your question in.
Hello?
Hi. Got just a few seconds to get your question in.
Hi. I was wondering what John Green's proudest moment as an author is, or was.
Thank you very much for the call.
Oh, that's a great question. Gosh. You know, my first book won the biggest award in young adult fiction. It's called the Michael L. Prince Award, and it's a huge deal. In fact, the new winner was just announced yesterday, Marcus Sedgwick, who's a great writer. And when I won that award, when I found out that I'd won it, I happened to be walking down the street in New York City. My parents happened to be there. My dad happened to have a camera out. I happened to be with the woman who was about to become my wife. We were walking to Macy's to shop for the wine glasses we were going to put on our wedding registry when I got this phone call saying that I'd won the Prince Award. And it was so out of the blue, and it was so wonderful to be honored by these librarians who were on the committee who I value so much and whose opinions I'd taken so seriously as a reader myself for so many years. And to have my parents there who supported my whole career, supported me, the idea that I would be a writer, even when it seemed like a crazy thing, like being an astronaut or something, it just meant everything to me. So that was probably my proudest moment.
That's a great last word. John, I'd like to thank you very much for joining us again. We had a bunch of questions and calls we couldn't get to. I hope you will come back. I'm John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producer, Sharon Alseth. Interactive Media Coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical Producer, Jeanette Rhodes. And Board Engineer, Don Hibschweiler. We invite you to join us each week for No Limits, made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.